Ridiculous History is a production of iHeartRadio. Welcome to the show, Ridiculous Historians. Thank you, as always, for tuning in. This is part two of our strange dive into a tureen of turtle soup history.
What's a tureen?
A tureen is like a thing where you hold soup, right?
Oh, I didn't know that. Is it like a gravy boat?
Yeah, I guess it's like a super gravy boat. So like in Secret of the Ooze, you know, when the animals get accelerated by the mutagen, maybe a tureen is like a gravy boat with like a mutagen-powered gravy boat. If you look up tureen, they're fancy.
Oh my God, Ben, you're right. It's like a leveled up gravy boat or like a casserole or something. Also, seemingly a requirement is for it to be ornately decorated with flowers and leaves and decorative handles. Well, anyway, we digress. Here's the episode.
Recipes for the fake or mock turtle soup appear right around the time that real turtle soup recipes appear.
So interesting. Because, yeah, you're right. I mean, like you said, it was mock turtle soup that was served at Abraham Lincoln's first inauguration because the times were a little tighter and, you know, turtles were not as easy to come by. I don't know. That doesn't make sense in terms of, like, the scarcity of the actual turtles, but they were expensive and it was just much more austere times. But mock turtle soup had already become a British classic. Heinz, like we said earlier in the show, when something really starts to break through in the zeitgeist in terms of culinary stuff, it ends up in mass-produced cookbooks, and Heinz was one of the big ones. It was in their cookbook, and then they eventually even canned it and made a version that was like mass-marketed. And even if it was something that, you know, more people could have access to, it didn't mean that it was something that your average home chef could just whip up because some of the stuff is like literal butchery, you know, where you really have to know what you're doing. Some of the process involved dressing a calf's head, which started with opening the skull. No small task, and extracting the brains and then the face meat and the tongue. And then the meat has to be boiled before letting it stand overnight. So this is really a quite disgusting to do, but it was hugely popular. This whole idea of boiling a calf's head seemed for some reason to be really appealing. It was considered high end, even though it was essentially trash meat, kind of like the way Edward Bernays made bacon popular amongst the plebs.
Interesting point. Yes. Also, shout out to Fergus Henderson, the luminary behind one of my favorite restaurants, St. John in London. Fergus, if you're hearing this, you'll love the following part. Mock turtle soup took the world by storm. And really, when we talk about mock turtle soup, we're talking about calf's head soup. We're talking about a name change, right? We're talking about branding. Because when people started making mock turtle soup, what they're doing is they're reproducing that rendering of fat, the green fat of the turtle's body versus the fat of the head of this calf. There's a long tradition of sheep or calf head soup. We have to remember, even though it might be cheaper than a gigantic turtle, a calf's head is still kind of high end. You know what I mean? You're buying the whole head. When's the last time you walked into a supermarket and said, "I'll buy the whole head"?
Yeah, no, that's not something I would ever hope to find myself doing. But I see the logic. Even though it is typically the part that gets thrown away, it does feel like a big to-do, you know, when you're getting the entire head, brains and all. It's all in how you sell it. It's all in how you spin it. And when it starts ending up on menus at places like the Waldorf Astoria or the Plaza Hotel, the St. Regis Hotel, even in the White House's 1887 official cookbook, and that's when you start to see the more like kind of fancy spice blend and seasoning with sherry, cayenne pepper, lemon, sugar, salt, and mace. And that is kind of what I believe is considered the classic recipe for both turtle and mock turtle soup in terms of like the base seasonings. And it's so interesting because, you know, what essentially is just a totally different soup unto itself was created, you know, not to trick people, right? Like not to, it wasn't trying to mislead people. It was called mock turtle soup, but it was just like such a, it had such a place in people's hearts and minds, this turtle soup, that it just really sort of took hold in and of itself. And maybe where when even when turtle soup fell out of fashion, mock turtle soup mm-hmm. became more popular than the original turtle soup, to the point where Lewis Carroll, you'll probably remember in his 1865 Alice in Wonderland, had a character called the mock turtle. And Alice says in the story, I don't even know what a mock turtle is. And therein kind of lies the joke, because aside from the boiled calf's head, I think that's sort of the point, is you don't really know what's in mock turtle soup.
What is a mock turtle? It's the thing mock turtle soup is made from. Lewis Carroll, also, by the way, very creepy dude. Very, very creepy guy. I'm sure that many of our listeners today are aware of this. Yeah, you're right, though. Mock turtle soup became its own sort of acknowledged thing that had very little to do with actual turtles. I know you guys have not eaten turtle or mock turtle, maybe yourself, but I have. I have eaten both. Actually, I guess technically, I've eaten multiple things that would qualify as mock turtle soup, but I've eaten actual turtles as well. I would still do it if it were not for their endangered status.
Well, Ben, does it taste, is it as advertised in the lore? Does it taste like a combination of shrimp, pork, veal, beef, and chicken all rolled into one?
I think it depends on how you cook it, man.
Fair.
Also, why soup? Why soup and why not, say, a fricassee, a filet, etc.? It's because this was a way to culturally frame the consumption of offal, O-F-F-A-L, all that stuff that you usually don't see on a restaurant menu, right?
Yeah, and that's because in the 40s, you know, it sort of mattered. It was almost like a national campaign to try to convince regular folks, you know, civilians, to eat all those leftover bits, because the tastier bits, the chops and the steaks and all the cuts people are used to seeing, were being shipped overseas to feed soldiers during the war. And they were left with a surplus, you know, we as a country were left with a surplus of hearts and kidneys and brains that were, they are ultimately sources of protein. So it seems a shame to waste them. So you're left with a situation on how do I package this up so that people can stomach it, literally.
Right. How do we make it seem fancy to eat these things that are ordinarily treated as throwaway cuts? How do we persuade people to enjoy this, right? How do we make it acceptable and bonus points or stretch goal, they would call it? How do we make it aspirational?
With marketing.
There it is. The shadow of Bernays.
Exactly. Exactly. And so instead of calling it offal or trash meat or gutty parts, they coined the term. It was actually Margaret Mead, this cultural anthropologist who was working with the Department of Defense with some food scientists and some home experts. And they created this marketing campaign around this offal, the gutty bits. And they coined the term, and I think this is pure genius, variety meats.
I think it's pretty good. I think it's 7.3 out of 10. It's like the same reasoning with Halloween candy. With the little candies they call fun size. I speak for every childhood trick-or-treater when I say, how can something be fun when there's less of it? So anyway, yes, variety meats. They're doing their best. And this is a product of austerity during World War II. But after World War II ends, the U.S. encounters this huge economic boom. It's one of the few countries that didn't have its infrastructure bombed into ruins. So people in the U.S. just go back to steaks and burgers, and they keep skipping, you know, the sweetbreads, the pancreas, the trotters, the food, the offals, the Rocky Mountain oysters were probably still a thing, because people will always be weird. But but there was one exception to this rule. It was the calf's head in mock turtle soup. The real name for this soup should have been cow head soup, calf's head soup. But that also didn't last forever. Mock turtle soup was popular till about the late 1950s. By the 1960s, it was considered increasingly anachronistic. It was fancy anachronistic, like a double-breasted suit coat or a monocle.
Yeah, or like aspic, or, you know, cooking, making savory gelatins, for example. There's a restaurant in Atlanta that's actually, I think, in danger of closing. It's called The Colonnade. It's like an old meat and three type, you know, super old school restaurant. And they have aspic on the menu still, because it's just a holdover. Some people just don't change with the times, and that can actually be charming in small doses. But, you know, society can't sustain just a ton of those. There's like the few little holdouts. And in this case, the holdouts were luxury passenger liners like the SS United States and the Carriage House in Fort Worth, which was a fancy French restaurant. Because this is the kind of thing, like the aspect, that I could see the French, you know, kind of hanging on to for a little longer. There are reasons that we can pretty easily pinpoint as to why people aren't into eating gutty parts so much anymore. It's because we don't have to, and they're kind of gross, and they seem like the parts you should leave. I like a tongue taco, I'm not going to lie. I've talked about my history with eating liver pudding and brains and eggs. Not something I would go for on purpose these days, but I also like liver. I do like fried liver and onions. So that's probably the most acceptable of what would be considered the awful. But all the rest of that stuff, still available from your local butcher, but usually more by request, right? It's not like there's a whole heaping case full of awful parts, right?
Well, it depends on where you go.
Also true. In different countries, it's a different story too.
Sure, yes. And the grocery stores I go to have awful aplenty, but you're right. I talked about this on Stuff They Don't Want You to Know, the soft cultural taboos of what is or is not acceptable to eat. And these are relatively arbitrary things. Why do I not see turtle soup on my menu, Ben? You might be asking yourself, you son of a fish. Why did you all spend two episodes talking about this turtle soup and I cannot order any of it? Well, the explanation lies in a couple of factors. First, courtesy of our friend Gabe Lousier, one of the answers may be indoor plumbing. Indoor plumbing decreased the average homestead interaction with the turtle, because you're not going to creeks. You're not going into swamps. You're not going into the wild to grab your water, which means you may not be seeing a turtle. And then also, going back to what I said earlier about the soft cultural taboos of what is or is not to be eaten, turtles started to enter the realm of dogs and cats, in that they were becoming somewhat anthropomorphized. You know what I mean?
Well, sure. The aforementioned Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. You got your Yertle the Turtle. You got, what other turtles you got? There's that turtle in the Tootsie Roll Pop commercial that everyone likes so well. Yeah, I've brought this up before, maybe not on this show, but I think on Stuff They Don't Want You to Know, where it's like the cultural taboos around eating certain animals. I always feel like there's not a clear line in the sand with that, because I know plenty of people that have pet rabbits, and rabbits are uniformly cuddly and sweet, even though they can be a little bitey and feral. But, you know, people still eat rabbit stew, mainly at higher end restaurants, but that's still definitely on the menu. Rabbits that are bred for slaughter. Turtles, on the other hand, you know, people can still keep a turtle as a pet, you can still find a traditional type of box turtle like you might have when you were a kid, but now that's crossed the line. After being so insanely popular, I'm fascinated by that. One thing that I thought was interesting too is it's hard to tell the difference between a more common turtle and some of its more endangered brethren. So that's an important thing to consider as well.
There's another thing that's interesting here. So post-World War II, that's when we really see the decline of turtle soup as both an aspirational thing and an actual thing on menus. We have to mention that the decline was sort of signaled or telegraphed in advance by the end of World War I. Way before World War II, Prohibition comes in. As every gourmand knows, one cannot have proper turtle soup without sherry. And if you can't have sherry, then you can't have turtle soup. So it suffered under Prohibition. And we know from previous episodes, people weren't really following the laws of Prohibition. But when there was no fortified wine that was easily available, obviously people weren't making the turtle soup the way they liked to make the turtle soup. And then post-World War II, the decline is accelerated because you got convenience foods. It's the nuclear America. We've got frozen TV dinners. We've got better canned soup. We've got mixes. You don't have to spend hours and hours every day cooking over a smelly pot. You no longer have to find a huge turtle, a Casey verified size of a large dog turtle, and hang it from its back fins.
You know, it never occurred to me that Prohibition would have really done a number on flavoring and sauces, because there would be no cooking wines, no liquors for making sauces, which is really important. I mean, a little white wine in like a shrimp scampi or something like that. I mean, that you really need it. And the irony is the alcohol burns off. I guess, Johnny Law just couldn't trust Americans to just cook with their sherry and not take a little sip. They had to take an all or nothing approach. Thank God we got through that. But yeah, this was in fact a nail in the coffin for turtle soup. No sherry, you don't have the soup that you're used to. But you're right, Ben. You know, lumped in with that, as we heard from the Heinz company, there were canned versions of mock turtle soup. It did kind of get its moment, brief as it was, as a convenient food, but it just didn't stick. Campbell's did not continue to make their version of mock turtle soup. It was described as having a tempting, distinctive taste, so prized by the epicure at the time. And that was before 1960, but it didn't have the sticking power that, like, you know, your cream of mushroom and chicken noodle would have had. Though it did have its devotees, one of which was Andy Warhol, a Campbell's soup can enthusiast and apparently a big fan of mock turtle soup. He even said he likes to shop for discontinued flavors. If you ever run across mock turtle, save it for me. It used to be my favorite, but I must have been the only one because they discontinued it.
Ridiculous Historians, you're saying right now, obviously, this sounds amazing. Where is my turtle soup? Where is my mock turtle calf's head soup? Well, we have an answer for you, and that answer is Cincinnati. The love of mock turtle soup continues in the modern day. I'm sorry to sound a little Rod Serling about that, but it's true. This is a solved mystery. There is a Twilight Zone turtle soup part of the U.S. German immigrants traveled to Cincinnati in the 1800s, and according to Sherry Brinkman, who wrote a fantastic book, Cincinnati and Soup, or a fantastic series of cookbooks, I should say, the mock turtle movement continues in Cincinnati. She says, today, Cincinnati chefs make the dish with ground beef rather than offal, but it's just as popular as ever. It's still made by many local restaurants and at church festivals. You can also order canned mock turtle soup from a company called Worthmore. The thing is, let me be honest with you guys. The thing is, the canned version includes the hard-boiled eggs. I'm just so skeptical. Canned hard-boiled eggs, like,
oh God,
I want to believe, you know, I feel very David Duchovny about this, very Fox Mulder. I want to believe, but I'm skeptical.
Yeah, I'm fine with not believing in that one. Canned hard-boiled eggs, like the idea of pickled eggs just makes me want to puke. I don't care for it. I like hard-boiling my own egg. I also don't like store-bought hard-boiled eggs. Something about that, I just need it to be, you know, a me thing. I will say, though, as far as a hard-boiled egg in a soup or a soft-boiled egg in a soup, like, you know, those ramen eggs are really tasty. And they're sort of like marinated in soy and mirin, and they have a really nice kind of umami to them in and of themselves. But they're a nice little added seasoning for a bowl of ramen.
Yeah, I got it. I prefer, if I'm boiling an egg, I prefer to be the boiler, you know?
Same, yeah.
I like that vertical integration without me laying the egg. That's the threshold.
Fair.
But, well, Casey, what do you think? Would you buy hard-boiled eggs in a can?
No, I can't say I would, Ben.
Casey on the case.
How about mock turtle soup, Casey? Would you try that or regular turtle soup?
I would do the mock turtle soup. I don't think I could bring myself to do the regular turtle soup.
You're okay with boiled calf's head, but not turtle meat.
You know, people are strange.
When you're a stranger. Yeah. So here's the thing. Real turtle soup is increasingly difficult to get these days because, as we mentioned earlier, these animals are endangered or they may be rare. So the idea of processing them for soup takes an understandable back seat. You can find a couple corners of the internet. You can find people selling canned turtle, actual turtle soup, not mock turtle, but it's going to be pretty old at this point. There aren't fresh canned varieties, meaning that if you are eating at a fancy restaurant and you're eating actual turtle soup, it is probably fresh made. One would hope. Otherwise, don't tip. I'm kidding. Always tip. Always tip. Minimum 20%. Be a good person.
Indeed. And I think this concludes our foray into the weird and wonderful, questionably, world of turtles as a cooking ingredient. I've enjoyed it. It's not been the most appetizing conversation we've had in recent memory, but I think I'm going to go and make some non-turtle soup after we get done here for lunch, just to kind of cleanse my palate, which has sort of a greasy patina on it now. But huge thanks to you, Ben, for joining me on this journey and being here, you know. But huge thanks to you, Ben, for joining me on this journey.
Thanks to you as well, Noel. Huge thanks to super producer Casey Pegrip, Alex Williams, who composed this amazing soundtrack, and of course, Christopher Hasiotis.
Thanks to researcher extraordinaire Gabe Lussier, Jonathan Strickland the Quizster, and don't forget, if you would like to find us or our show, we are available on social media channels. Of note, the Twitter, the Pinterest, no, not the Pinterest, never the Pinterest, bringing that one back, and the Instagram. You can find us as a show or as individuals. I am on Instagram at HowNowNoelBrown.
You can find me on Twitter at BenBullenHSW, and you can find me on Instagram at BenBullen, or at number one leaf blower fan on Pinterest and MySpace.
For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.